70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
KBS 日本語放送のライフワン。お便りモンスター。
Hi, my name is Matsumoto Takuya, aka Letter Monster, an avid listener of KBS World Radio's Japanese service. My radio name Letter Monster comes from the fact that I send letters to KBS World Radio almost every day. I've been listening to KBS World Radio for the past 48 years. I still remember vividly the tense moments when I heard major news stories of our time, such as the assassination of President Park Chung-hee in 1979, the bombing of the Korean Air Flight in 1987, and the bombardment of Yongpyong Island by North Korea in 2010. The always accurate, fair coverage by KBS World Radio helps me navigate numerous sensitive issues between Korea and Japan, such as the colonial era's comfort women and forced labor, with a balanced perspective. I hope the two countries will continue to move forward hand in hand in the future, and I promise to tune into KBS World Radio's Japanese service for years to come. Thank you.
ずっと聞いていこうと思います。ありがとうございました。
70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it's Tuesday the 30th of May, and welcome to another edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The head of the National Election Commission has issued a public apology over allegations of nepotism by several executives at the election watchdog. We'll have more in news briefing shortly. New research has found that more than half of the world's largest lakes and reservoirs are shrinking due to climate change and human activity. We speak to one of the co-authors of the paper for our in-depth today to find out more. And coming up for Touch Basin's Hall, we connect with Filipino basketball player Renz Abando, a member of Anyang KGC, the KBL champions this year. Let's begin Korea 24. Allegations of nepotism involving incumbent and former executives of the National Election Commission are escalating. This has rocked the government watchdog, and it has led to the head to offer a public apology as well. For more on this story and other headlines from today, I am joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Daniel Chair. Daniel, hello.
Hello there, Jungwoo.
So the NEC is in hot waters with calls for its chair to step down growing as well. Can you give us the latest?
Well, as you mentioned, NEC Chair Noh Tae-hyuk apologized and he said he plans to conduct a comprehensive internal investigation and will announce its position on Wednesday. There are growing calls for Noh to resign, mainly coming from the ruling People Power Party. The election watchdog on Tuesday held an emergency meeting to discuss self-reform measures to improve and change hiring systems. Depending on an internal audit, the agency is also reviewing requesting a formal investigation as a civic group has already filed a complaint and the ruling People Power Party is considering similar moves. PPP Chairman Kim Gi-hun called for a proper investigation instead of an internal probe, while its policy chief Park Dae-chol vowed to get to the bottom of the scandal by all means. Earlier, the commission found that a conflict of interest was not reported when the agency hired six children of current and former NEC secretaries general, a deputy secretary general, and regional standing committee members. At least five additional cases have since been confirmed, with the number likely to grow amid an ongoing inspection. The Anti-Corruption and Civil Rights Commission has also opened an investigation into the hiring suspicions. Two major figures under suspicion, NEC Secretary General Park Chan-jin and Deputy Secretary General Song Bong-sub, both offered to resign immediately after the speculation came to light on Thursday and remained tight-lipped, offering no comments on the matter. The NEC hired 75 experienced workers last year compared to just 26 in 2018, while those employed through open recruitment fell from 110 to 77 in the cited period. Some suspect the increased figures in experienced workers may be linked to nepotistic hiring. Unfair hiring is taken very seriously here in Korea, and it's considered by some hyper-competitive society, especially for public sector jobs, where there are often higher bars to entry than private sector jobs. Some say there's more honor, prestige, and stability involved as well.
Well, we'll see what this internal investigation brings up and follow this story as it develops. Let's move on to our other headlines now. We reported yesterday that North Korea had notified Japan and the International Maritime Organization of an imminent satellite launch. Well, the regime has made an official announcement now. A senior North Korean defense official said on Tuesday that North Korea plans to launch its first military spy satellite in June. Can you tell us more?
That's right. In a statement carried by the North Korean Central News Agency, Lee Byung-chul, vice chairman of the Central Military Commission of the Ruling Workers' Party of Korea, announced a plan for the launch of military recon satellite number one. The regime earlier notified Japan of its plan to launch a satellite between May 31st and June 11th. Lee said the satellite, with various recon capabilities to be newly tested, are indispensable to tracking, monitoring, and coping with the what they call dangerous military acts of the U.S. and its forces in real time. The official also accused Washington of conducting hostile aerial espionage activities over the Korean Peninsula and the vicinity, calling them a serious threat to the North and other countries in the region. Ri stressed North Korea will comprehensively consider present and future threats and thoroughly implement activities to strengthen comprehensive and practical war deterrent capabilities.
Following Pyongyang's announcement, the South Korean military has begun a defense exercise near the five northwestern border islands in the Yellow Sea.
The three-day drills led by the Northwest Islands Defense Command involving the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines began on Tuesday around the islands of Paengnyeong, Yeonpyeong, Taecheong, Seocheong, and Udo. The first time in 6 years the command resumed the formerly biannual combined training. The drills will cover various scenarios amid the North's evolving security threats. The military has reinforced its readiness posture. Seoul and Washington reportedly mobilized South Korea's RC-800 and RF-16 recon planes, and America's U-2S high-altitude strategic recon aircraft and RC-12X special electronic mission aircraft to monitor developments in the regime.
Meanwhile, a high-level international forum on the prevention of trafficking of weapons of mass destruction began on the country's southern island of Jeju.
The government announced the meeting of the U.S.-led Proliferation Security Initiative, which marks its 20th anniversary after its inception by the Bush administration to stop the trafficking of WMDs, their delivery systems, and related materials. On Tuesday, day one of the four-day event, the participants assessed achievements made over the past two decades and discussed current non-proliferation challenges. South Korea also plans to hold the multinational maritime exercise Eastern Endeavor 23 on the occasion of the PSI meeting. South Korea's decision to join the PSI in 2009 was met with strong criticism by North Korea, which warned Seoul's participation will be regarded as a declaration of war.
In other news, President Yoon Suk-yeol and the leaders of Pacific Island nations have agreed to expand cooperation following their summit in Seoul. Can you tell us more?
The leaders reached the agreement on Monday in the inaugural summit between South Korea and the countries of the Pacific Islands at the former presidential office of Cheongwa-dae. The leaders adopted a joint statement presenting a vision to build a partnership for the freedom, peace, and prosperity of the resilient Pacific through cooperation while maintaining regional peace and stability. The two sides also expressed mutual support of Korea's Indo-Pacific strategy and the Pacific Island nation's 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific continent. They also agreed to expand cooperation in the maritime, climate, energy, cyber, and health areas, among others. South Korea pledged to double its official development assistance for Pacific Island nations to 53 billion won, or about $40 million by the year 2027. The statement confirmed the importance of protecting the seas and marine resources from pollution due to radioactive waste and substances, in an apparent reference to Japan's plan to release contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear plant. The two sides also agreed to foreign ministerial talks biannually and continue with summits.
Meanwhile, the defense minister, Lee Jong-sup, will not conduct a fleet review of a Seoul-led multinational naval drill this week amid an unfavorable weather forecast.
According to the Defense Ministry on Tuesday, the Proliferation Security Initiative's Eastern Endeavor 23 exercise aimed at interdicting the maritime trafficking of WMDs will be scaled down. Multinational maritime training involving ships from participating nations will be conducted informally in international waters off the Korean Peninsula. Tuesday's drills include South Korea's Wanggeon destroyer, the U.S. Milius destroyer, Japan's Hamagiri destroyer, Australia's Anzac destroyer inspecting telecommunications networks in international waters south of Busan on Wednesday. The vessels will move to international waters south of Jeju Island to carry out computer-simulated maritime interdiction training before returning to their respective countries. The South Korean Navy and Coast Guard alone will conduct an embarkation inspection drill with a Wanggeon destroyer and a Coast Guard vessel. Earlier, the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force warship arrived at the Busan port with the Rising Sun ensign hoisted. Many countries deem the flag's usage unacceptable given its association to Japan's imperialistic atrocities.
Turning now to the National Assembly, on Tuesday, lawmakers voted down the disputed Nursing Act, which was put up for a re-vote after President Yoon Suk-yeol vetoed the opposition-pushed bill earlier this month. Can you tell us more?
Yes, of 289 lawmakers in attendance, 178 voted for the legislation, 107 against, 4 abstentions. A vetoed bill requires two-thirds approval, meaning the support of at least 193 lawmakers is needed. The outcome was widely expected as the ruling People Power Party holds over one-third of parliament. After the second vote, the bill is scrapped. The opposition-led parliament approved the Nursing Act late last month, but Yoon exercised his veto powers, saying the legislation causes excessive conflict among medical professionals. Proponents of the law believe it will improve working conditions by specifying the roles and duties of nurses to prevent overwork. Critics contend it authorizes nurses to interfere in the duties of doctors and possibly provides legal grounds for nurses to open their own clinics.
We'll wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Daniel, thank you for those updates.
Thank you so much for having me.
The amount of water stored in more than half of the largest lakes and reservoirs around the world is declining. That's according to new research recently published in the journal Science. Previous studies showed the world's arid areas will become drier under climate change and wet areas get wetter. However, this new study found significant water loss even in humid regions, chiefly because of climate change and human activity. To learn more about this worldwide trend, we are joined on the line now by the co-author of the study, Professor Rajagopalan Balaji from the Department of Civil, Environmental and Architectural Engineering at the University of Colorado Boulder in the US. Professor Balaji, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, Professor, I would describe it as a grimly fascinating discovery that you and your colleagues have found. Can you first give us details about the study? How did it come about and how was it conducted? I understand the basis was 30 years of satellite data.
That's correct. So the challenge with the lakes is that they are not monitored regularly and well-managed, like, say, river systems. Everybody knows rivers. We monitor how much water is in the river, whereas lakes are all over the place. Some lakes are well-managed. Some are absolutely not managed. So what makes it challenging is that the lakes don't have continuous records. So that's why the studies have been limited to, you know, one or two iconic lakes, you know, importantly, the Aral Sea. That's sort of the poster child of lakes losing water, and a few others in the Great Salt Lake, although it's not used for human consumption, but it's also a very important lake. So what we did was, step one was to piece together different or disparate satellite data sets, each one going to different lengths, different resolution. And the lead author, Professor Dr. Fang Yao, he had developed a methodology to estimate and reconstruct lake bathymetry and lake levels using satellite observations. And that kind of was a game changer in that suddenly now we could use that methodology over many lakes across the world. And so he had to do two things. One is piece these things together and develop 30 years long, continuous, coherent lake data set. And that enabled us to look at the global perspective of lakes across the globe.
Mm. Right, using this methodology of satellite data, you were able to painstakingly analyse decades' worth of information to try and find out if we were seeing water levels in lakes and reservoirs changing. Was there suspicion already that water levels were receding in the first place? What prompted this research?
So I think, as I mentioned, lakes are the most, they are life-affirming. Mm. In fact, although we think of rivers is where civilizations have sprung up, which is true, but if you look at it, about a quarter of world's population lives in a watershed that has a lake that they draw water from. So it's not just humans, but livestock, ecology. I mean, they are life-affirming, and yet they are also what I call the neglected stepchild of water resources management. The rivers get all the attention. The lakes are absolutely, and in fact, if you go to developing countries, I mean, I grew up in India. You know, there were several lakes in every place that I grew up,
right.
And people just would trash it. And some lakes are just people just build buildings in there, and then when rains come, there is flooding, and they wonder why. So you treat them badly, they treat you. I mean, they're not going to take care of you. So that is what really got us motivated, is once we have this data set, we thought the first thing is just let's just look at the trends. You know, that's easy to do. You know, long-term trends, let's look at them over the entire world. And we had some hunch. There have been studies of Aral Sea and, you know, these kind of pockets here and there.
Right.
And we thought the dry regions would probably show more decline. But we were quite surprised at what we found, that even, like you said in your setup, that even the humid areas exhibited declining trends, or the lakes and humid regions also exhibited. Yeah.
So can you further sum up what was found in your research? How have the lakes and reservoirs around the world been drying up over the past three decades?
So our findings are pretty simple. About 50% of the lakes, and we only look at large lakes, we define large as anything that's over 100 square kilometers in area. And about 50% of the world's large lakes that hold fresh water is in decline. So that's number one. Mm. Two, that itself was not very, you know, when we saw that, we said, okay, great. You know, if those 50% of those lakes are all in Canada and Arctic, who cares, right? So it's not, it's interesting, but not very, okay, people might shrug off. Then what we decided to do was to see, look at the population database and sort of get a rough estimate of how many people actually live in and around these lakes. Mm. And so that really made us, you know, sit up, which is a quarter of the world's population lives in a watershed where there is a fresh water lake that is serving them. And that is a pretty alarming and sort of, as we said, a wake-up call, right? So that is the two. And the third one is, like you said in the piece, the decline is happening all over, you know, in humid and dry.
Mm.
And the fourth, what we found is there is a general lakes that are showing declining trends are also seeing in their watershed climate generally aridifying, meaning, you know, the climate is moving towards aridification. Mm. And so human consumption, the gradual trend towards aridification contributes to the decline in lakes. So those are sort of our four key, you know, key findings.
Right. I understand that you narrowed down three causes as well, natural changes, climate change impacts, and human impact. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, and the latter two are, of course, the most concerning.
Absolutely. And it is sort of interrelated. The way to think of it is, you know, warmer climate, obviously, the most obvious impact with the warmer climate is temperature going up, so which means you have increased evaporation from the lake. That's number one. Two, there's also increased transpiration from the vegetation in and around the lake, which means they're going to pull water from the lake as well. Three, if you increase the temperature, number of hot days, then people are also going to need more water, livestock is going to need more water, and so there is also a human demand that is also going to increase. So the temperature, the climate warming signal kind of pervades and threads through all aspects, not just the supply, but also on the demand. Mm. The precipitation is a more interesting thing. In some places, precipitation is increasing. In other places, precipitation decreases. But what you also see is increased frequency and magnitude and duration of these extremes, which means when you get a drought or a dry spell, they tend to be much more intense than they used to be. Mm. So now you coupled all of this, there is a significant downward pressure on these lakes. The last point I would make on that is lakes are also very interesting. They are highly nonlinear. The analogy I give is of a soup bowl, like everybody can relate to. So you have a bowl of soup that's full, and then you start, you know, taking the spoonful of soup. When you're taking it at the beginning, you take two or three spoons, and you look, there is still a lot of soup left. Then suddenly there comes a threshold where you take that spoon full of soup and then you quickly stare at the bottom. It's like, what happened? That's because the lakes are all nonlinear. They are like soup bowls. So when the level gets to a certain threshold, then it is just going to rapidly decline towards extinction. So that also catches people by surprise. Unlike rivers, which are, you know, it's dry this year. Well, next year it rains or snows and the river is flowing full. Whereas with lakes, unless there is a river or lake that is continuously feeding it, you can quickly, you know, run these lakes to the ground without even you realizing. And so that's why, you know, you add the nonlinearity on top of all of this, that the lakes are very vulnerable. And yet, you know, even though they are so life-affirming and, you know, they sustain life and for humans and ecology, but we tend to neglect them in many places.
Right. So then what does this all mean? What impact or risks does this trend pose? And do you think this trend is going to continue?
That's a very good question. So the impact is, you know, some is obvious, which is, you know, the lake levels go down. That means people have less freshwater source, so they have to truck water from somewhere. Or what they do is they willy-nilly drill wells around, you know, it's like, hey, there's no lake water. I'm going to drill well and, you know, drill it deep. So what is that doing? That is actually sucking the water from the lake and making it worse and, you know, making the decline even quicker and faster. So the decline is obviously the water quantity or supply goes down. Two, as the levels go down, water quality also degrades. So that is something that we don't think of, but that is equally important, right? When you have a lot of fresh water, quality is good, just like in the rivers, you know, you have flowing water. But if the water is stagnant and it's declining, the water quality also rapidly declines. If there are lakes that are used for, say, hydropower, well, you don't, you know, you quickly run out of that capability as well. And if the lakes are a main source for ecology, for birds, well, that is also now in danger. And so the ripple effect, the first order is obviously water quantity and quality, but then the ripple effect subsequently for humans, for ecology, can be pretty devastating.
Right, so the consequences are something we definitely need to be wary of. With that in mind, now that we know this situation, what measures can be taken by governments, regions, countries to mitigate this situation? What kind of management solutions are there that you can suggest? Because, as we said, two of the main causes were climate change and human consumption. I guess there's something we can do about human consumption, but with climate change, there's not a lot we can do immediately.
Yes, and I think this was something that we, obviously this was not part of the scope of the study, but we have been thinking quite a bit subsequently, because we know this is something that people will be more interested in. Is okay, tell us now, what can we do? So number one, what we seek to do with this study is not to alarm people, but rather raise the awareness.
Mm.
Okay, and again, lakes are also a funny thing, because people don't think of lakes, you know, somewhere lake is drying, yeah, no big deal. But if my lake in my neighborhood dries suddenly, then it is like everybody's problem, right? So in that sense, lakes are so localized that people, unless they see it themselves, whereas with rivers, you can see it because these are usually flowing across different states and countries. Mm. So, you know, people see it and it's much more visceral. But with the lakes, unless you see it in your neck of the wood, in your neighborhood, you're not going to get all worked up. So awareness is very important. Two, I think you probably saw the website, webpage that our lead author, Dr. Fang Fang, put together. In fact, you can go on that webpage, you can click the lakes that we analyzed, 2,000 of them across the lakes and reservoirs across the world, and it'll pop up a window and give you all the details, you know, what's the trend, is it wetting, it is drying, is it a natural lake, or is it a man-made reservoir, and all the other details. So having this information at your tips is crucial. That's number two. So anybody who wants to look at their lakes, look at how their particular lake is behaving, now they know what it is doing, and they also know how it is relative to other lakes in the region.
Right.
Three, we hope with this methodology and the data set being available, that and the methods being available, that people will then look at even smaller lakes or lakes that are less than 100 square kilometers. So that is where, in fact, even large number of the world's population is served by lakes that are smaller than 100 square kilometers. So that is number three. Four, lakes are often used as standalone water supply. Okay, so what does this mean? This means the management is left to local. So every lake is managed locally. I mean, even within the same district, Lake A is managed by some group. Maybe it's managed very well.
Right.
Lake B in a neighboring town is totally different. Maybe it's trashed.
Right.
So they are not integrated with the public entities.
Right.
And so, for example, you know, water utilities, say, like, you know, Korean Water, which manages and supplies water supplies to people, they're not looking at lakes. They are only looking at whatever water that they
right.
draw from rivers, which they then treat and supply to customers. So what needs to happen is the lakes have to be managed in a integrated manner with all other water resources.
Mm.
So no longer you just leave each lake to its own devices or its own groups. Then what happens is this will lead to overexploitation and suboptimal management. So what we are saying is that people need to start thinking of managing these lakes in an integrated manner. So which means, let us say, the entity that's managing the rivers in that watershed should also include the lakes, so that you can, for instance, let us say if a district or county has five lakes,
sure.
managing them together with a river, for instance, means if one lake is going down, then you want to make sure that you conserve water
right,
there
right.
and you use other lakes, water from other lakes. So that integrated management is what I think people need to start thinking. And then overall awareness is key. Ultimately,
right.
making healthy water levels a priority will be required for good management practice. And then once it gets into the public's mind, all of these things, I always believe, you get the public involved, they will demand, hey, you know, we can't draw down, or we want to maintain the quality, we want to maintain the levels. And it then becomes a top and bottom down together
right.
That that will lead to more sustainable and sort of reliable lakes. And, you know, lakes provide so much life, not just life, but also recreation. And then, you know, people want to live around lakes. You build apartments around lakes, you get good lake view. So there are so many benefits that we derive, and yet we don't treat lakes with the respect and regard they deserve. And we hope that this study raises the awareness, provides the tools, provides the data sets for future studies,
Professor.
But also for the public and water entities to really use this and manage the lakes in a more holistic and integrated fashion.
We are out of time, Professor, but yes, it is a very concerning phenomenon that needs our attention indeed. We'll wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Professor Rajagopalan Balaji from the University of Colorado Boulder. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to speak with you. Have a good day.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index jumped 26.71 points, or 1.04% on Tuesday, to close the day at 2,585.52. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also gained, rising 8.27 points, or 0.98%, to close at 851.50. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 0.41 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,324.91.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. Here we round up some of the other news stories that have been attracting attention online. And for that today, we have with us our contributor, Diane Yu. Diane, hello. It's great to see you again.
Hello, Jango.
Okay, let's get into our first story. What do you have for us first?
What was meant to be an exciting festival for families to enjoy together in Haman County, South Gyeongsang Province last weekend, turned into a fiasco for tens of thousands of visitors. According to the estimates from the police and fire departments, between 50,000 and 60,000 tourists flocked to the Nakhwa Nori Festival held last Saturday, resulting in chaos. Tourists from all over the country who visited the festival complained that it was, quote, the worst festival, a disaster, and even hell, unquote.
Wow, so those are some extreme words indeed.
Right.
For our listeners who may not know, the Nakhwa Nori Festival is an annual event where visitors are able to see traditional Korean fireworks and light shows.
Right.
It is said to be very beautiful.
Very beautiful.
How did an event that is often enjoyed by all ages become such a fiasco?
Well, the main issue was that Haman underestimated the number of people who headed to the county, located some 350 kilometers southeast of Seoul, to attend the festival.
Mm.
The annual event normally accommodates about 8,000 people, but there has been an increase in the number of visitors. Last year, more than 10,000 people attended the event. Accordingly, the county set the maximum capacity for this year's festival at 22,000 people and set aside 5,500 square meters of land. However, more than twice the expected number was gathered at once. The number was equivalent to the entire population of Haman County and five times the number of visitors last year.
Wow. So, as you said, it was up to 60,000 people that reportedly flocked to this event. And it seems that the organizers were unprepared for such numbers.
Yes.
We, of course, learned from the tragic Itaewon crowd crush in October last year that fatal accidents can occur when there are large crowds gathered in one area.
Right.
Were there any serious incidents due to the sheer number of visitors?
Fortunately, no one was seriously injured. However, 228 reports of traffic congestion were received by the police, and 7 reports of danger, including the risk of being crushed, were received as well. So you can picture how it would have been for the tourists there. Even cell phones and the internet were not working as the area was just too crowded. So Cho Geun-jae, the governor of Haman County, issued an apology on Sunday, the day after the festival. Cho said he sincerely apologizes to those who were not able to watch the festival because of the unexpectedly large crowds. He added that the county will thoroughly prepare for all upcoming festivals and events so that the same problem does not occur in the future.
Yes, it sounds like they might not have factored in the fact that this would be the first year for the event to take place without pandemic restrictions as well. So, as we said, it had been rising, the popularity of this event, but it would have been exponentially so this year, especially with no restrictions or concerns in place. As we said, thankfully, though, no one was hurt, but there was the potential for disaster, it seems. And unfortunately, people had a terrible time as well. Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Opening a convenience store was considered something people do later on their lives. However, in Korea these days, the numbers show that more and more people in their 20s are jumping into owning and running their own establishments. According to the retail industry on Monday, as of 2022, the proportion of store owners in their 20s among the country's three major convenience stores, CU, GS25, and 7-Eleven, increased each year over a three-year period. The percentage of young owners in all three brands saw a huge increase in 2022, with the percentage of the said owners surpassing 16% in one major convenience store brand.
Okay, this is interesting. What's the reason behind this sudden jump?
It's because people in their 20s are opting to start their own business rather than seek employment. Although the convenience store business carries more risks than typical establishments, the younger generation is eager to open up stores as it requires less initial capital. It's a high risk, but it's less expensive to start, so the entry barrier is low. Mm. Also, considering that convenience stores are one of the rapidly growing industries after the COVID-19 pandemic, the investment value is great, with potentially high return on investments. Another advantage is that it does not take much time to learn how the business works. It's simple enough that even part-time workers are able to grasp the ins and outs within a week.
Right. I think there is a growing desire for young people to be their own boss as well, rather than join the traditional rat race of an office job as such. I imagine there could be advantages as well for the companies to have younger store owners, such as offering fresh new ideas to cater to younger customers.
That's right. People in their 20s are sensitive to trends, so it's easy to target the main customers with new and trending products. However, there are concerns about younger people rushing to open convenience stores, and the industry official has advised people to carefully deliberate before opening a store, as the profits may be disappointing. In the case of convenience store in commercial districts, they can make several times more profit than ordinary office workers, but in other places, the profits may be smaller.
Right, but it looks like more and more young people are ready to take on that risk.
Yeah.
It's certainly a fascinating shift. Okay, let's quickly move on to our third story for today. Diane, what else has been trending?
South Korea successfully launched its homegrown space rocket NuRi last week, which was a huge milestone for Korea's science field. Now, the attention has moved to quantum physics. According to the Ministry of Science and ICT on Tuesday, Quantum Korea 2023 will be held at the Dongdaemun Design Plaza in Seoul from the 26th to the 29th of next month. Under the subtitle Quantum Jump into the Future, this top-notch international event looks into the global trend of quantum ecosystem innovations.
Okay, so a forum on quantum physics. Can you walk us through who will be attending?
Great scholars, government representatives, and leading companies from home and abroad are expected to attend. At the opening ceremony, John F. Clauser, an American scholar in the quantum field who jointly won the Nobel Prize in Physics last year, is expected to give a special lecture. Clauser received the Nobel Prize for experimentally proving that one of the phenomena of quantum mechanics called quantum entanglement actually exists. His findings became the basis for the birth of quantum communication and quantum computers.
Yes, quantum computers. That is where there has been a lot of interest, especially in the commercial field. So I understand that there was a leading scientist related to the development of quantum computers that will also be attending this forum.
Yes, so Professor Peter Shor of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, will give a keynote speech on the third day. Shor discovered the Shor algorithm, which became an important motivation for the development of quantum computers by showing that they can perform prime factorization calculations faster than conventional computers. On our side, the Ministry of Science and ICT is scheduled to present the National Quantum Vision and Development Strategy at the event. The strategy will include content such as quantum science technology R&D, the human resource development roadmap, and infrastructure expansion and international cooperation.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up there for today's Korea Trending. Diane, thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Anyang KGC were crowned champions of the Korean Basketball League this year after beating the Seoul SK Knights in a thrilling seven-game series in the finals. The achievement added to the team's impressive displays this year, having won the regular season title as well as the East Asian Super League Champions Week in March. Our guest today is a player who joined KGC from the Philippines last year as part of the expanded Asian player quota system to include players from the Southeast Asian nation. He became an integral part of the team in just his first season in the league. And to tell us all about his incredible achievements and more for today's Touch Base in Seoul, we have joining us via video call now, Renz Abando, who plays as a guard for KGC. Mr. Abando, hello, and thank you for your time today.
안녕하세요, and thank you for also inviting me here.
Well, first off, a huge congratulations to you and Anyang KGC for winning the KBL Championship. Tell us, what was it like? What went through your mind when your team were crowned champions?
To be honest, like, I have a lot of mixed emotions. I don't know what to feel. That moment, I don't know if it's true or not, but I'm really, really happy and thankful because that's my biggest accomplishment in my life.
Well, it is a huge accomplishment, and we can see that you have brought the trophy with you next to you, which is a treat for our YouTube viewers as well when this interview goes online. So what was it like to lift that trophy as well, to touch that trophy, to have it feeling in your hands? You said it didn't feel real. Did it feel real when you touched it?
Yeah, like, actually, like, about the trophy. I mean, when I lift that one, like, yeah, this is true. And I made it. We made it.
You made it. You certainly did. It was an incredibly hard-fought battle as well, though, in the final. The SK Knights, they pushed you all the way to game 7 in the series. And also that game went into overtime as well, where you just managed to win with 100 points compared to 97 posted by the Knights. Reports have described it as the most intense seventh leg in KBL history. How difficult was it, both physically and mentally, playing in that final game?
Oh, the final game is like really, really tough. You need to be mentally and physically ready. You need to be ready because they're very tough. They're the champion last year, so we need to be ready.
Mm. And then afterwards, how did you celebrate? Did you do anything special?
After like winning the championship, we just eat at the restaurant. It's like an eel. No, what's it eel? But the locals eat the eel, but me and my co-imports, like, they buy us some beef.
Ah, so you got given some special beef rather than the local specialty, which is eel, as you said. And did you manage to talk to your family back home as well?
Yeah, after the championship, like, I called my girlfriend and also I called my sisters, my family, and that's it.
Well, you had an incredible first year in the KBL. As I said earlier, you're one of several players from the Philippines that have played in the league this season after the Asian quota rule was expanded. We've talked to some of your compatriots as well. What was it like when you first arrived in Korea last year? What did you know of the league and what were your expectations? Were you excited or nervous when you first arrived?
When I first arrived here, like, I'm very, very nervous because I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I just keep fighting. I just keep thinking that this is for my future, this is for me. It will benefit me for the long run, and I just keep thinking about the future. And then, but I know it's gonna be tough, it's gonna be hard, but just keep holding on.
Well, you said you knew it was gonna be tough and you knew it was gonna be hard. What was it like actually playing then in the KBL against the other teams? Was there an adjustment? What was different about it compared to when you were playing in the Philippines?
Playing here in KBL is like really, really tough. You need to be mentally focused, physically ready, because they're like very talented here, a lot of talented, and also the pacing is very fast. You need to like move every time they're moving, so you need to be focused and ready.
Right, so it's the speed, you're saying, that's probably the biggest adjustment?
Yeah, the pacing, probably.
Right. And what about off the field as well? What was it like adjusting to life in Korea? Did you miss home at all?
Actually, sometimes I miss home, but I don't think about it a lot because I'm just focusing. Like, I think I'm just focusing right now what's in here, and I'm just enjoying, even though because sometimes it's not that good, sometimes it's not that bad, but I'm just enjoying what's right in the moment.
One thing that you didn't need improving in your game was your jumping ability. You seem to virtually out-jump everyone on the court. And in fact, you won the dunk contest at this year's All-Star game, right? You had some amazing dunks that really wowed the judges and spectators.
I'm sorry.
What was it like to win the dunk contest this year at the All-Star game? Because I know you had some amazing dunks. It was pretty incredible to watch.
Mm-hmm. Actually, like, I was happy because I win that one. It's an another is like, I don't know what to say. Like, I'm just happy. Yeah. That's it.
Well, did you always have that ability, that jumping ability?
Yeah, I think I have this since I was a kid, and I didn't work hard for me to, for my body to make that jump. I just work some workout. I just do some exercise to strengthen my lower body and my whole body.
But it's a lot of natural talent then. A lot of natural
talent.
Yeah, it's
natural.
That's amazing, and Korean fans were really amazed by what you did that day. And obviously what you did throughout the season, you've really become an important part of the team. But now you're in the off-season. I understand that you will be with Anyang next season as well.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do with your time off now? Are you going back home?
Yeah, probably. I'm going to my home and just forget basketball. I'm just gonna enjoy my vacation, and then after my 2 months break, that's it. I need to be ready again.
Right. So you're gonna forget everything about basketball then? Are you gonna do any training at all?
I've been doing basketball for like how many months before I came here? Like I'm playing college, and then I played national team, and then just came here. Basketball again, so I need something. I need some break.
Well, you definitely deserve a good break, I feel. But still, coming into next season, you must be excited as well. What areas of the game are you looking to improve for next season for you personally? What can fans expect from you next season?
I think I need to, I've been mentioning this, I need to improve my individual and also my team defense. I need to adjust, and also I need to improve my consistency, because sometimes I play bad, sometimes good, but sometimes, most of the time, like I play bad. And to the fans, like I think they expect a more explosive next season.
Well, I'm sure fans will be excited to see you next season, and I'm sure we'll see a more improved version of you as well. Now that you know what the league is about, it will be your second season, so I'm sure you'll be more used to it and you'll know what to expect. In the meantime, though, congratulations once again, and we hope you enjoy your time off. We've been speaking to Renz Abando from Anyang KGC. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sports around the peninsula. Then on Tuesday, notable guests from various fields join us and give us insight into their lives and work. Are you a fan of books? Then tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our book critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Go on an adventure with us every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explore Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And to bring us those stories, we have with us today our trusty staff editor, Richard Larkin. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first story that you have for us today?
Well, over the past couple of years, there have been discussions about the issue of needless waste due to item-specific parts for tech products, mainly for smartphones. Just last October, the EU decided to pass a rule that would require all smartphones to have a USB-C connector for their charging ports to reduce waste. Also, there have been calls from lawmakers in countries around the world to make it easier for consumers and independent repair shops to repair smartphones. Mm. Well, now in Korea, it is possible for consumers who have certain Samsung devices to repair the products themselves. That's what Yoo Ji-soo's article in the business section of the Korea Herald is about.
Yes, I believe this is an expansion of a service that has been available in the US since last year as well. It's now available in South Korea, you're saying. So how can Korean consumers fix the devices themselves now?
So the South Korean corporation announced its self-repair service program on Monday. Under the program, consumers are able to buy DIY kits as well as parts for key products, such as smartphones, laptops, and TVs. Before, you could only get the repairs if you visited a service center. Right now, not all products are eligible for this program. To find out if the device that you have is eligible, you would need to check out the website. Mm. There are also manuals and video guides to help consumers repair their broken items.
Yes, this has become a global trend over the past year or two, right?
Right.
And Samsung is not the only company to have a program like this.
Exactly. Since the right to repair was recognized by the US, the UK and the European Union, more companies are looking to adapt. Big companies such as the computer manufacturer Logitech and the American tech company Apple have similar programs. They are also following the trend to be more eco-friendly. Under their programs, consumers will receive a refund if they return the old broken parts to the company to be recycled.
Yes, so the right to repair, it's become a key issue now for consumers. It's in fact starting to become law in some places, so companies are having to respond. But yes, it will be a welcome development for Korean consumers that Samsung has made this service available here now as well. Okay, let's move on to our next article. What do you have for us?
I have chosen an interview with Yi Sang-gun, who is also known as Chef Steve in Hong Kong. It can be found in the trend section of the Korea Times. Reporter Kang Hyung-kyung sat down with the 31-year-old Korean chef to discuss his career and Hong Kong's dining scene.
Wow, only 31, so yes. He's still young. Can you walk us through some of Yi's notable achievements?
Sure. The article really goes into detail about his career. He initially worked as a chef in Sydney, Australia for a few years. He was then asked to become the head chef of a fine dining Korean restaurant in Hong Kong. He was only 29 years old at the time. Mm. Kang Hyung-kyung explains that Yi has had a pretty successful career so far. This year, he was the winner of the Young Chef Award at the 15th edition of the Michelin Guide ceremony. According to Michelin, the award is given to a young chef working in a selected restaurant and whose exceptional talent and great potential have impressed the inspectors.
Wow, that is a great achievement indeed, especially as it was only 2 years after he became a head chef.
Yes.
You mentioned that he works at a Korean fine dining restaurant. Can you tell us more about the food that he makes?
So the chef says that he tries to be faithful to the basics, for instance, the authentic flavors of Korean cuisine. The major changes he makes is that he uses locally produced ingredients, so there is a familiarity with local residents. The presentation of the dishes is also done with a modern twist.
Hmm.
You can read more about the chef's career, the food, and more in the article, so I think it is worth the read.
Even though we haven't really talked much about it, whenever we talk about food in this segment, my stomach always starts grumbling.
Me too.
So let's quickly wrap it up. But for those interested, you can learn more about Chef Yi in tomorrow's Korea Times. Richard, thank you as always, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that brings our show to a close. We'll be back again tomorrow, of course, with the latest updates and analysis of key stories from Korea. Till then, we hope all our listeners have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.